Hello and welcome to the December 2007 edition of Hot Type, Security Books and Audio, brought to you by CertSecurity.com and Addison Wesley. I'm Billy Hurley. As always, our Hot Type podcasts bring you free excerpts from recently published information security books, read by the authors themselves. Today's featured author is David Rice. For a decade, David Rice has advised, counseled, and defended global IT networks for government and private industry. David has been awarded by the U.S. Department of Defense for significant contributions, advancing security of critical national infrastructure and global networks. Additionally, David has authored numerous IT security courses and publications, teaches for the prestigious SANS Institute, and has served as adjunct faculty at James Madison University. He's a frequent speaker at information security conferences, and currently he's the director of the Monterey Group. David authored the new book, Geekonomics, The Real Cost of Insecure Software. The book addresses how simple mistakes in software have had severe consequences, costing businesses and individuals billions of dollars every year. In Geekonomics, David Rice explains how the trend of poor software development can be reversed. David, welcome to the program.
Great, Billy. It's wonderful to be here.
David, are we getting any better at fixing up software flaws?
That's a difficult question. You could say yes and no. Yes, from a certain perspective, because software manufacturers are doing their best efforts to try to make software better and more reliable, and they are focusing on security. But if you look at the general trend, though, we still have this enormous outcropping of cyber criminals, cyber espionage, maybe on cyber warfare. And all these things, of course, are typically targeting cyber systems, or at least, you know, the software and the vulnerabilities that exist in them. So in one sense, we can answer yes, but the better question is probably to pose that to the attackers. And my guess would be that their answer would be decidedly no. We just aren't getting better, at least not such that the effect is a resulting in a reduction in cybercrime, cyber warfare, and cyber espionage.
Should the software industry be held more accountable?
In general, that's true for any industry. Right now, again, as I said, software manufacturers are making their best efforts. And you'll see trustworthy initiatives, you'll see all sorts of things of people trying to declare themselves hacker safe, et cetera. And those are all good to a certain extent. And the problem is that these claims can be made from really any standpoint from the manufacturer. So what this means is that while the claim can be made, if something should go wrong, they can really just shrug their shoulders. Now, are they really shrugging their shoulders? No, because they are bearing a certain cost for when they get software production wrong. That much is obvious. But in general, the social cost is even greater. For instance, let's say it takes a software manufacturer $200,000 to $300,000 to fix a particular bug. That sounds like a lot of money, and indeed it can be depending on the size of the software manufacturer. But when you look at everyone else who has to patch their software, patching simply is not free. So that means thousands upon thousands of companies, the more companies in fact that have adopted the software, the more companies have to patch themselves, means that the expense is huge for the community. So what we say is that the software manufacturers are the least cost avoiders. It may indeed be expensive for them to fix a bug, but it's even more expensive for everybody else. So should they be held more accountable? Yes. And usually that means some type of an incentive structure, whether it be through a taxation model, whether it be through legal liability, something to say like, listen, we know that, you know, you might get something wrong, but toasters are guarded under strict product liability. We have all sorts of products that undoubtedly benefit civilization, toasters, cars, aircraft, aeronautical charts. So an operating system is undoubtedly beneficial to everyone. I like operating systems. Lots of techies like operating systems. We all have our favorites. But that also means that should they get something wrong, the radius of risk is enormous, especially for a general purpose operating system. The fact that it can go on anything, a car, aircraft, you name it, well, the radius of risk for the users are undoubtedly huge. So accountability is simply the same model we've used in every other space. And the huge public policy issue that Geekonomics is trying to address is software so special that it shouldn't be accountable when they get something wrong? And that's an open question. At least Geekonomics argues that, yes, we should have more accountability.
So if we don't see progress soon against bad software, what do you think will be some of the bigger consequences in the future?
Well, there are a lot of dangers that we can ruminate about into what might happen if we don't fix the problem. In one case, if we don't do anything, people say, well, the market will somehow react to this and provide the fixes that we need. But to date, we really haven't seen that. We've seen the market respond, but the response has been ineffectual, or at least not nearly what we would like. 98% of companies have firewalls. 97% of companies have antivirus. You still see a rampant increase in cybercrime, and that's troubling. So if we don't fix bad software, the trend will probably be just more troubling than it is now. Insecure software communicates the message of disorder into the cyber environment, which means that a patch or, you know, anytime you see a vulnerability report come out or a patch be released, it is a beacon to everybody in cyberspace that we got something wrong, which invites more people to the feeding frenzy. So that weakness invites cyber criminals, invites more cyber espionage or people who practice cyber espionage. So we see just this growing trend, this attraction of all these people into a space because they know no one's in control of software, not governments, not manufacturers, and certainly not consumers. There's all sorts of problems with this very, very complex product. And so if we don't have some type of incentive model that's different than the current one, the trend only promises to be troubling. Will it be disastrous? Will, you know, all of civilization crumble? Probably not, because humanity has a really good way of withstanding all sorts of, you know, cataclysmic events and, you know, naysayers and doomsayers. But this imposes an enormous cost on us all, and what we have to look at is what cost are we willing to bear? So that's an open question also, and something like economics tries to address.
Thanks, David. And now, without further ado, here's a selection from Chapter 2, 6 Billion Crash Test Dummies, Irrational Innovation and Perverse Incentives.
Market failure martini with a twist of lemon. Irrational innovation exacerbates the lack of security in the software marketplace. When a product is distinguished by fewer and fewer aspects, imbalances arise, particularly regarding the amount of information available to buyers compared to sellers. If the imbalance is great enough, the market breaks down. In the case of software, we've seen that features tend to be the single most important aspect to buyers. Features, in other words, are the sine qua non of value. Without features, one software application is all but indistinguishable from another. But this leads to an imbalance of information. Purchasers focus on features because features are the primary aspect by which software applications can be distinguished. As discussed previously, however, the count of features is what is apparently most important in buying decisions, even though a majority of features go unused after purchase. Other information about reliability, security, and interoperability might be considered by the buyer during the purchasing process, but not nearly to the same extent as feature count. In essence, the buyer is told more through marketing and sales, and thus knows more about features, which are obvious, and little about everything else. A similar information imbalance was identified by George Akerlof's paper titled The Market for Lemons, for which he won a Nobel Prize in 1970. His essay identified shortfalls in the used car market where sellers know more about the quality of a used car than buyers. Where this information imbalance exists, price becomes the distinguishing element in purchasing decisions and eventually overshadows all other considerations. What Akerlof noted was buyers, uncertain of the used car's quality, tend to demand a lower price. This makes intuitive sense. If a buyer is unsure of the product's quality, the buyer will most likely not make a fair offer for the product, given that the value of the purchase is questionable at best. As a result, sellers who are offered discounted prices for their products tend to withhold high-quality vehicles from the market because a competitive, or even a fair price, is not likely. This also makes intuitive sense, considering that if I own and wish to sell a pristine condition Chevy Nova, I would probably think twice about selling my car if I knew I could not get what I believe is a fair asking price. I will withhold my higher value vehicle from the market. The actions of both buyer and seller coincide with the assumption noted earlier. Users will follow their self-interest and will not do anything that makes them worse off. The buyer will offer a discounted price regardless of whether the quality of the used car is acceptable, because to offer more might affect him negatively. That is, spending more money when it might result in purchasing a vehicle that breaks down before he arrives home. The seller is not going to put a high-quality used car into the market because to do so would mean having to contend with discounted prices which do not reflect the fair value of the car. This vicious cycle repeats itself, constantly lowering the price as well as constantly lowering the quality of cars sellers are willing to put on the market. As a consequence, higher-quality used cars are forced out of the market entirely, leaving low-quality cars, lemons, who dominate. The important aspect in this vicious cycle is that sellers always know more about the quality of a car than buyers and are in a powerful position of determining whether a car should be put on the market. It is the buyers in the market who are disadvantaged by lack of information, not sellers. Buyers, then, who obviously are ignorant of the car's quality, must make the assumption that quality is low. Why else would the seller be selling the car? They cannot help but offer discounted prices. The information imbalance leads to inaccurate and incomplete information sharing, which eventually detrimentally affects all participants in the market. Unfortunately, the software world is not much different than the world of used cars, at least from a legal perspective. Software, like a used car, is sold as is, with no warranty guarantees. In the software market, the quality of a software application is truly unknown by the buyer. Yet whereas price is the dominant consideration in the used car market, features are the dominant consideration in the software market, and as such, tend to overshadow all other considerations, at least until it is too late to do anything about them. Buyers of software, just like buyers of used cars, cannot help but employ anecdotal evidence to judge the likely quality of a given software application. Having heard about and personally experienced multiple latent defects and glitches in software, and 77% of the population have experienced said glitchiness, buyers tend to only focus on those elements that provide a discount for their inconvenience. As it turns out, because buyers cannot discount the price of software, they accept the software and demand another form of discount, features. In effect, features are the discount that software buyers expect and software vendors willingly provide to offset the egregious lack of quality, reliability, and security in software applications. The greater number of features in an application, the more likely a buyer is willing to tolerate other missing aspects to a certain extent. As discussed previously, the number of features in a software application can be clearly demonstrated to buyers via tables or comparison charts on software packaging and marketing materials. In comparison, quantifying the stability or security of an application is much more difficult. Remember, there is no 5-star rating system for software, or any meaningful standard rating system at all. Therefore, information about quality and security of a software application might be known only to the seller. The imbalance of information favors the seller because buyers are incapable of discovering less obvious aspects of the product. Features, then, are much more visible and apparent in the market, whereas security and reliability are less so. That is, until the product reaches its tipping point in popularity, at which point security becomes a substantial concern. By then, as mentioned before, it is too late. Once again, when one aspect of a product tends to dominate the buying decision in the minds of buyers, it becomes much easier for the seller to obfuscate other aspects such as quality or security. The buyer's inability to easily distinguish between high and low quality products makes it increasingly difficult for high quality products to compete in the marketplace. As a consequence, high-quality software is driven from the market, leaving low-quality and feature-rich software to dominate. But here is where the story is at its darkest. In reality, neither party in the software market has clear understanding of software quality. Sellers actually have no more knowledge than buyers. Sellers with no compelling incentive to conduct thorough testing and with little willingness to implement thorough testing in the first place due to market pressures realistically have no idea about the stability or security of their own product. Documentation, which explains how the application is intended to operate, goes unwritten, not merely out of laziness, but in actuality because decent documentation would mean the software vendor has an idea how to articulate their understanding of application functions in the first place. This is not always the case. Oftentimes, documentation goes unwritten because knowledge of the application's real functions was lost days after the code was first developed. Once that knowledge is lost, it is like trying to write about your earliest recollections of childhood in a university creative writing class. Sure, parts of the story are true, but mostly it's fantasy. In more than a few instances, a software developer, even after just a few days have elapsed, might have forgotten, or worse yet, never truly knew, how his code accomplishes what it does. The software might have efficient code. It might be elegant code, and it might even abide by the software company's coding standards. But these judgments are highly subjective and without any reliable or relevant meaning to the seller, the buyer, or the marketplace. It compiles. Ship it. There are huge swaths of code embedded in the fabric of our society for which no one has any memory of how it works or what it does internally. Nor might anyone make a meaningful statement as to the code's quality or reliability, It might work, but no one knows how or why for certain. This state of affairs is as far from the notion of discipline in engineering as a profession can get. The foundation of civilization deserves more.
Thanks, David. That was author David Rice reading a selection from his book, Geekonomics: The Real Cost of Insecure Software, published by Addison Wesley. Listeners to this podcast are eligible to purchase the book at a special discounted rate. To learn more and to check out our other information security podcasts, visit our podcast page at searchsecurity.com/podcast. I'm Billy Hurley. Thanks for listening.